And today we have another special guest, Tom Lockley, who is the DUA trustee from our district, which includes Southern California, Southern Nevada, I believe all of Arizona, and then New Mexico. Okay. Tom has served as a trustee on the district since June 2006, and he has an unexpired term from a departure of Reverend Ed Wright from the PSW district. He's a 28-year member of the Orange Coast Unitarian Universalist Church in Costa Mesa. He has previously served on the PSW's board and a compensation consultant for the board for 8 years, and he was president of the Benville Pines and lives to tell us. Currently, he serves as secretary of the National Association of Unitarian Universalists, and he's a member of the Committee on Committees. There really is such a thing. He's responsible for selecting nominees for various committees and board appointments. He's also a member of the board coordinating committee, which assists in establishing priorities. Isn't that what we do every day and every week? Tom lives in Orange, California. He is employed as a manager of a health system management company, married to Nancy, and he, who is also former PSWD district president, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
It's a family thing. He has 4 grown children, and he has more information available on the web. And I want to share with you that when we have a guest speaker, we usually have a gratuity to that guest speaker, and Tom has asked that his gratuity be sent to the district for leadership development. Please welcome Tom Lockley.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you, Dick. And thank you for being here today. Last Sunday, I was in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And one of the things that they do is they have some flute music at the beginning of their service. And they had a Native American doing it. And I have to tell you, I think it's better here than it was in Santa Fe. One of the nice things about this job is I do get around to a lot of different places. Next Sunday I leave for Boston, and one of our 4 quarterly meetings of the Association Board of Trustees, we start on Tuesday morning and we finish Sunday night the following. So they are long, long, lengthy board meetings. This is the longest one, particularly of the year. A week ago Thursday, on September 24th, the Reverend Forrest Church, long, long serving minister of the congregation in New York City, All Souls, passed away after a lengthy illness with esophageal cancer. 1 week before that, my stepfather passed away from the same disease. Forrest Church had a lot to do with my thoughts about being a Unitarian Universalist. Forrest Church was probably the closest thing we have to a modern-day theologian in the ranks of our ministers, working ministers, in congregations throughout this country. He was the son of Frank Church, the former senator from the state of Idaho. A terrific guy, if you've ever met him. He was marvelous in the pulpit. And his writings, he wrote over 25 books, the most recent of which is yet to be published. And one of them was Born Again Unitarian Universalism, that he wrote back in the early 80s. And it's a book I got back then that I went through, and it helped me clarify a lot of my thoughts. And today I'm going to share some of those things with you on why I'm a Unitarian Universalist. And in remembrance, to some extent, of Forrest Church, the readings I've selected to include with my talk are from him. And I start with this. Death is central to my definition of religion. Religion is our human response to the dual reality of being alive and having to die. We are not the animal with advanced language or tools as much as we are the religious animal. Knowing that we must die, we question what life means. The answers we arrive at may not be religious answers, but the questions death forces us to ask are at heart religious questions. Where did I come from? Who am I? Where am I going? What is life's purpose? What does all this mean? Well, for myself, I don't care to wait until I'm at death's doorstep to start trying to answer these questions. In fact, I think most of us at some level begin to ask ourselves these questions in private moments of contemplation, meditation, or, if I may dare say it, prayer. Sometimes the questions arise from times of loneliness, stress, and turmoil, or maybe even depression. As we try to deal with whatever is going on in our lives at that moment, we begin asking, why is this going on? What have I done to deserve this? Is it all part of some grand plan or some cosmic joke playing itself out with our lives? I think we all have that experience to some degree or another, but more often we begin pondering these weighty questions much more quietly, and not out of desperation, but out of some longing to know that which we don't. For myself, it was out of some quiet place that I began asking these questions. As a child, I went to my parents to a Presbyterian church. It was a small town in New Jersey, and it seemed all my friends either went to the Methodist church two blocks away or to our church. A couple of friends went to a neighboring town that had a Catholic church, and I think at least one friend went to a synagogue somewhere. I'm not sure where it was. Then there were a few who did not seem to go anywhere. I felt sorry for them. They seemed to be left out of something that I took for granted as being just part of what you did. Frankly, I could tell no difference between the Methodist church of some of my friends and my own church. For that matter, I couldn't tell much difference between my Catholic or Jewish friends. We all seemed to share the same values in school and around the neighborhood, including the guys who never went to church at all. I distinctly remember asking myself the question, why do we all go to different churches? Temple was kind of a strange word for me back then, when neither we nor the churches seemed to be very different. I can also remember thinking that while we all seemed the same, there were clearly people on the outside who were obviously different. How come we did not have any blacks in our church? Our town was surrounded by farms, and every farm had a group of black migrant laborers who came and went. They lived in squalid conditions. Why were we never doing anything to help them? When the message that we seemed to be hearing every week was about Jesus caring for all of us, it sure seemed he didn't have much time for them. The questions would not go away. In fact, as I thought about them, I only began to have more questions. Where did I come from? Who am I? Where am I going? What is life's purpose? What does it all mean? My normal, everyday life came to a sudden and jolting end in 1962. I was 14 years old. Everything I'd taken for granted came to a screeching halt. My mother got my brothers and sister together one day and told us that she and my father were getting a divorce. We would be moving from this small town in New Jersey to Florida to be nearer to my grandparents. Everything was uprooted: schools, friends, scouts, church, our house, everything. It all happened overnight. How could this happen? What had we done? What had I done? How could a caring God do or allow something like this to happen? There were only a few logical answers to that question. God was too busy, or God simply did not care. But I'd always been reassured that God did care about each of us and that God listened to all prayers. So what could it be? I drew the only conclusion that I could, and that was that maybe, just maybe, there was no God. It began to make sense. The different churches and faiths all seemingly the same. The terrible living conditions of people whose only differences seemed to be the color of their skin and their terrible poverty. A world that seemed to be on the verge of destroying itself over some little island called Cuba. You have to remember it was 1962, and actually as we drove to Florida, we pulled off the road and it took us an extra day to get there because of all the convoys of tanks and trucks and soldiers all heading to South Florida to prepare for an invasion of Cuba. I can remember that distinctly. My mother and my father not being together was the biggest shock of all. Was the only answer that made any sense, that there was, in fact, no God. All of a sudden, the big questions had answers. They didn't have much to do with God. Where did I come from? I was born. That's it. Who am I? I'm whatever I make of myself. Where am I going? Wherever I end up. What is life's purpose? To get through it and get by. What does it all mean? It means whatever becomes of me is up to me. The center was not holding. If it was God who held the center and kept things under control, it simply wasn't working. I found I was becoming, in the truest sense of the Greek word, atheist. Not atheist, atheist. Without God. I felt duped by the people who had convinced me that if I played by the rules, everything would be just fine. They weren't, and I was not going to waste my time on that nonsense any longer. Well, now, fast forward a few years. Wife, two kids, jobs, back to school to finish college, friends, school, family, security, no church. Sunday mornings were for reading the paper, maybe playing some golf, watching a pro football game. Life seemed complete. For me, anyway, but Nancy felt something missing for our kids. She wanted to check out a church. A church. A church. We'd known about this Unitarian church nearby in Pittsburgh, and Nancy had found a small fellowship when we moved to State College, Pennsylvania. I said, fine, go if you want. You can tell me about it when you come home. Of course, when she did, I couldn't believe it was church. They played recorded music? Who? Jimmy Buffett, she said. You're kidding me. Which songs? Cheeseburger in Paradise? Let's Get Drunk and Screw? You're kidding me. In church? Well, this I had to see and hear for myself. It was not Jimmy Buffett the next week, but neither was it the old rugged cross or Onward Christian Soldiers. No crosses, no prayers, no promises of salvation, just messages of inquiry, hope, love, social justice, compassion, each and every week that I went. And it was the same in the Sunday school, which I found was called religious education. A hymnal with a few of the songs I remembered from my childhood, and for some that did seem familiar, I think they changed some of the words. It took more than a year to join this odd little place. I found I enjoyed the sermons, the music, and the people. We seemed to have a lot in common. So many, though, thought about religion the way I did, but at the same time, they seemed to take it to a deeper place. Over time, the questions that I thought I had answered so adequately more than a decade before began to occur to me again. Where did I come from? Who am I? Where am I going? What is life's purpose? What does all this mean? I was not as clear now in my answers to these questions. I'm still not. It's more than 30 years later, another fellowship in Gainesville, Florida during graduate school, and then nearly 30 years now in Costa Mesa. Becoming a UU is easy. We signed the book. Staying a UU is the hard part. We don't do this for the kids anymore. So why am I still a UU? What does being a UU mean? The answers to those rather basic questions came out of the more basic question, why am I a Unitarian Universalist? My reasons may be the same as many of you. It's kind of like a three-legged stool or a tripod. My foundations are in learning, justice-making, and community. I need all three, and without any one of them, the stool falls over. In my own congregation, we have a tagline that appears on our order of service every week, in our newsletter, and many of the documents we put out for public consumption. It says simply, seeking truth, building just communities, and caring for one another. I found this that matches up very closely with my own reasons for being a Unitarian Universalist. The common element that binds these three elements of my UUism is that they require active participation on my part. They don't simply come to me. I have to be proactive in seeking them out and in building relationship. As UUs, we have no promise of anything for simply being a UU. There's no promise of salvation, redemption, forgiveness, prosperity, or anything else just for signing the book or calling myself a UU. It is something that I have to work at. When I rejected the church of my childhood, one of the things that became part of my rejection was learning and expanding my thinking about these big questions. They'd been answered so that I had no need to do any more research or expand my thinking beyond the simple answers that fit my notions at that time. As I have become a UU, the big questions come back again and again, and I realized I simply did not have the tools I needed to be more involved in answering those questions. One of the things we do best as an institution is providing information. 30 years of sermons from people far brighter and more eloquent than me have been the basis for helping me understand the nature of these questions and some suggestions to the answers. As an aside, I'm not a minister, and I have come to have, as I write these things, I've come to have great respect for people who manage to do this every week and keep all of us interested. Thank you, Brother Dick. Covenant groups, where we have an opportunity to discuss these questions in small groups and in depth, saying our own truth, hearing it reflected from others, and maybe even being asked to view my own thinking through a different lens. Going to workshops on any variety of topics to hear others who have taken the time to explore a topic in great detail and then share it with me and challenge me to do something with it. Preparing for leading an RE class or an OWL class makes you examine your relationship and attitude to and with children and youth. Our UU youth do not accept being told this is how it is. You had better be prepared and know they will challenge almost everything and cause you to rethink your own positions and prejudices. Books from Beacon Press, the UU World, and other liberal presses provide a wealth of information. If we just look for it, our listservs that we have, and we have something like 500 of them now that you can sign up for, allow us to share information and new ideas with each other on thousands of topics every year. Do we ever have information? But as Albert Einstein reminded us, information is not knowledge. I see information much like tools in a workshop. Having them is the first step to being a craftsman. They represent potential, but only when they are used do they become real. That's knowledge. Taking information, ideas, and putting them to use. That's where the second leg of my reason for being a UU comes in. Justice making. As UUs, we have a very proud record of seeking to make a more just and equitable society. I see banners of it here in this room and the work that you do as part of that. We take great pride in our history of being at the forefront of social change for more than 200 years. When you look at the list of resolutions passed at General Assembly, we've been out there 10, 15, or 20 years in advance of the larger society adopting and grappling with the same issues. In our own congregations, we provide a major reason for being UUs with our social justice work. We bring energy, ideas, money to address the issues head on. Sometimes we're frustrated, but we're never turned back from the issues. We are looked at as leaders in our communities who know how to get things done. In collaboration with the UU Service Committee, we have for nearly 70 years committed to being champions for those who had no voice and few friends. How many of you know the story of the UUSC and its founding and helping to save Jews in Nazi Germany and other places? Today, with the UU campaign for Standing on the Side of Love, which has been expanded to an interfaith effort and a focus that goes beyond just marriage equality, we place ourselves squarely on the path trod by the abolitionists of the 1800s, the suffragists of the early 20th century, the civil rights activists of the mid-20th century, the peace activists of many generations, the prison reformers, the anti-racist, anti-oppression activists working today, and many, many more who have worn that path smooth despite the obstacles and the setbacks placed in their way. Today, we see congregations across the country contributing half or more of their Sunday collection to work being done outside their congregation and in their communities. Today, you and I join hundreds of other congregations contributing thousands of dollars to Association Sunday. We are at our finest and most generous when we look outside our own walls. We see a job that needs to be done, and we say, we can take care of that. Si se puede. Yes, we can. Now, one of the best things about all of this for me, and one of the major reasons I'm a UU, is the people we get to do this with. Most surveys of UUs, when asked why they come to church, why they stay as UUs, is the community. We love and care for our friends, and the friends we find in UU congregations is like none we find anywhere else. Not at work, not in our neighborhoods. Nowhere else do we find so many people who we respect for their convictions, ethics, compassion, commitment, values, attitudes, creativity, generosity, intelligence, fidelity, hopeful optimism, and most important, the love for each one another. We love our communities to such an extent that we fear almost anything that we perceive will threaten to change that community. Growth, doing things differently, challenging the status quo, don't come easy to us. Yet by not doing these things, we rob ourselves of the communities we may never know. One of the very best things about my involvement as an active UU is that I have communities in so many places now. I have a congregation in Costa Mesa, but I have one at the Benneville Pines. I have a congregation with the UUA board that I'll be meeting with next week. I have communities welcome me all over the country. In fact, I have a new one today. So what are some things we can each do to be better at being UUs? First and foremost, come to church every Sunday. Make it a spiritual practice. Don't worry who's speaking or what they're speaking about. Most of the time it's good to really good and occasionally great. Be welcoming. Enlarge your circle of acquaintances here at church. Say hello to a newcomer and find out something about them. Respect and honor those who are doing the heavy lifting, your board, your staff, the volunteers who make a quality service happen each week. Sing joyfully, even if you're not very good at it. This is one of the few places outside of the shower you can do that. When you see something that needs to be done, don't be angry that no one's taking care of it. Jump in and do it yourself. Be generous with your time and your money. Long after you've forgotten how much money you spent or how much time you took, you'll be able to look back with pride at whatever it was you accomplished. Join an activity at church that brings you some joy or sense of accomplishment. Making coffee, ushering, greeting, being on a committee, leading a discussion, moving some chairs. Well, there's some chairs outside, aren't there? Making some phone calls. Each of these will add to your sense of community. You will be loved for it, I promise you. Find out more about this faith of ours. Read the UU World. Buy Beacon Books. Join an adult discussion group. Sign up for a UU listserv on a topic that interests you. Go to the PSWD District Assembly in Santa Barbara as a delegate this next year. Go to the DeBenneville Work Weekend. Go to GA next year in Minneapolis. Visit a UU church when you take a trip somewhere. Speak up for those who have no voice. Write letters. Attend a rally. If you want something to change, be part of that change. Help in RE even if you don't have children at home. Lend a hand without being asked. I promise you, every one of these activities will deepen your life and will be its own rewards. It's why I'm a Unitarian Universalist. I'd like to finish with some words from Forrest Church. This is from a sermon he delivered February 3rd, 2008, a year and a half after he'd been told he'd be dead from his cancer. From a sermon called Love and Death. The word human has a telling etymology. Human, humane, humility, humus. Dust to dust. The mortar of mortality binds us fast to one another. All true meaning is shared meaning. I've said I didn't become a minister until I performed my first funeral. When dying comes calling at the door, like a bracing wind, it clears our being of pettiness. It connects us to others, more alert to life's fragility. We reawaken to life's preciousness. To be fully human is to care, and attending to death prompts the most eloquent form of caring imaginable. When those we love die, a part of us dies with them. When those we love are sick, we too feel the pain. Yet all of this is worth it, especially the pain. Grief and death are sacraments, or can be. A sacrament symbolizes communion, the act of bringing us together. To comfort one another is to bring her our strength. To console is to be with him in his aloneness. To commiserate is to share her pain. The act of releasing a loved one from all further obligations as he lies dying, to tell him it's all right, that he is safe, that we love him and he can go now, is life's most perfect gift, the final expression of unconditional love. We let go for dear life. Adversity doesn't always bring out the best in people, but the reason it so often does is because adversity forces us to work within tightly drawn limits. Everything within those limits is heightened. We receive as gifts things we tend to take for granted. For a brief, blessed time, what matters to us most really does matter. Yet how do we respond when we get a terminal sentence? Far too often with, what did I do to deserve this? Nothing. The answer is nothing. Against unimaginable odds, we have been given something that we didn't deserve at all. The gift of life, with death as our birthright. Unless we armor our hearts, we cannot protect ourselves from loss. We can only protect ourselves from the death of love. Yet without love, nothing matters. Break your life into a million pieces and ask yourself what of any real value might endure after you're gone. The pieces that remain will each carry love's signature. Without love, we are left only with the aching hollow of regret, that hunting emptiness where love might have been. What a luxury we enjoy, wondering what will happen after we die, even what will happen before we die. Having spent billions of years in gestation, present in all that preceded us, fully admitting the pain and difficulty involved in actually being alive, able to feel and suffer, grieve and die, we can only respond in one way, with awe and gratitude. We see little of the road ahead or the sky above, and the dust we raise clouds our eyes, leaving only brief interludes to contemplate the stars. All we can do every now and again is to stop for a moment and look. Look. Morning has broken and we are here, you and I, breathing the air, admiring the slant sun as it refracts through those magnificent pellucid windows and dances in motes of dust above the pews, calling us to attention, calling us homeward. Dust to dust, heart to heart. Thank you. First, how many of you even know we have an association of congregations? Oh, good. A few of you, though, don't. Okay, we do have an association of congregations. There are about 1,000 of us. There are a little over 50 congregations in this district. The way we organize ourselves is as an association, not as a denomination. We are associated as congregations. And what that means, basically, is that everything that you do is governed strictly by what you choose to do. There's no UUA telling you how to do anything. We offer resources, we offer advice, but that's about it. What you end up doing with it is your decision. Yeah. Yes, they stayed home on Sunday morning. It's actually more than that. A recent Pew study of religion in America found that when they asked people what they were, determined that about 800,000 plus people were Unitarian Universalists. But we have about 175 to 225,000 members at any given time attending congregations. I look in my own family. My wife and I are Unitarian Universalists. We have three children, one of whom attends regularly at a congregation in Cedar Rapids. Another one, a daughter who's on the faculty at Southern Illinois University, I asked her, when was the last time you were in church? And she says, Dad, when was the last time you visited? She falls into that category of the 600,000 plus that don't attend. I think being in sympathy with what we are as Unitarian Universalists, and if we ask my daughter, as a representative sample, what are you, she would say Unitarian Universalist. I challenge that and say, not really. As much as I challenge a Catholic who hasn't been to Mass in 30 years and calls themselves a Catholic, I don't think that that's what it's about. Being a Unitarian Universalist means showing up. It means being here and being part of a community and being in relationship with one another and what's going on. And without that, you simply aren't a UU. You may call yourself that. You may even have signed the membership book. But you're not really a Unitarian Universalist. Showing up, and more important, most important, being in relationship and being part of what's going on is what makes us Unitarian Universalists, and changing something, whether it's in our own lives or the lives of others. That's what makes us UUs. Now, having said that, there are people who are bona fide UUs who meet all those qualifications who don't show up in Sunday morning in this congregation or any other that we call a member congregation. Where are they? There are congregations that are meeting all over the place. Congregations of our youth form all the time at the Benneville Pines. They are, in fact, a congregation in my mind. There are people who get together as part of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee who are creating congregation in those senses. So while we say we have 175 to 200,000 plus members, in fact, as active Unitarian Universalists, and we look at attendance in church on Sunday mornings of people who haven't signed the book, we probably have about 300,000 plus people who really are in congregation as Unitarian Universalists. We need to keep working on that. We need to be welcoming here. We need to think bigger. One of the things that surprised me was one day we got at a UUA board meeting, we had an inquiry as to whether, how many of you know what Second Life is on the internet? Okay, not many hands. There's a place called Second Life, and it is this community that exists out there with tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people, and there is a congregation in Second Life, a Unitarian Universalist congregation that meets regularly. And we were asked, what would you do if an electronic fabricated church asked for membership in the association? What would you do with it? I'd be inclined to grant membership, but we haven't been asked yet. Our job, as I said before, is to build relationships with each other who are in sympathy with our purposes and principles. And that's what calls us together, and we build on that. Why we stay here is that we know that we're not done with that job. And the terrible truth is we never will be. So we've got to keep coming back week after week to find out what is it don't we know yet. I think part of it comes out of our history. And if you look at the New England congregations that commonly call themselves parishes, the first parish of Needham, Massachusetts, the first parish in Concord, Massachusetts, we see parish used a lot in that sense. I think particularly for many congregations that came about as a result of being Universalist, the word church was always part of the history of the Universalist church in America. From the time of John Murray back when it first came to this country. So I think we see that. I think that it's only really in the last 75 years that we've seen Unitarianism and Universalism developing the way it has, and not seeing itself necessarily as a Christian-oriented or one of the Protestant churches. Up until the first part of the last century, we really were defined as a Christian congregation, and we used the term church rather freely in that context. Today, I think we see a lot of people struggling with that. I know we do in our own church, and we've even thought about renaming ourselves as a society or congregation. Some have already taken that step. One of the things in my discussions with members who, or with friends, I'll be more specific, friends who come out of a Jewish tradition, one of the things that keeps them from signing the book is our use of the word church. That the connotation of that is Christian, when that's not necessarily what we're about at all. We have roots in that, but we also have roots in Jewish teachings as well. And so I don't know of any place that calls itself temple, but we have a lot of churches, and there are a lot of congregations that are giving serious consideration to the use of that word. I imagine we may see congregations in the future changing names. I think that's one of the things that's going to happen. But that's up to every congregation. That's part of our polity. I'm wondering, I'd love to be in your class when you go back and try and explain all of this to your comparative religion. If you can send us a message what you wrote, I'd be anxious to hear about it. Thank you. Enjoyed being here with all of you.